All right, good morning to everybody out there, and I want to welcome you to our Polar Connect event. Today is June 27th, 2014, and we're very excited that we'll be talking with Lauren Wattell and the team that is up at Tulik Field Station, Alaska. They're looking at the microbial changes in Arctic freshwater systems, and they are part of the Polar Trek program, which you're going to learn more about here in a little bit. Before we turn this presentation and webinar over to the team, we have a few things we need to go through to get us started. The first thing I wanted to share with you is the slide should have changed. The content on your screen should now be showing an image of Blackboard Collaborate. I'm sorry it's so small. I had a little technical difficulties this morning myself with the slides. Normally they're a little bit bigger, but I think you'll see that this gives you a general idea of how to use this platform. There's an area where you can see the research team. Good morning, research team. And they will be the only ones that we have video with today, just for bandwidth purposes. There's a list of participants, and you can probably see your name and others there. Above the list of participants, there's a little suite of icons. One of them is hand, and that, if you have a question as we go along, you can click on that icon, and that's like raising your hand and lets us know that you have something that you want to ask live. Below the list of participants is a chat room, and you can type things into the white text at white space at the bottom. Type it in, hit enter, and it goes to everyone in the main room. You can also select people that you want to just chat with directly. This event is being archived, and we'll send out the archive and post it on the website after, within about 24, 48 hours of the event. And if you have any technical difficulties while we go along, please type them in the chat box, and Rhea, myself here at Arcus will try to address them. We do have a toll-free number you can call if you start having audio difficulties, and I can give that number out to you if you need it. I think that's it for Blackboard Collaborate. The next slide is just about introducing yourself to this virtual world we're in. So I want you to use that chat area. Type in who you are, if you're with a school or institution, or you're a relative or something, let us know. And if you have any others participating with you today, please give us a heads up on who they are and just give us an idea of who's out there, because sometimes it's hard to figure it out from the presentation. Again, before I turn this over to Lauren and the team, I just wanted to give you an idea of why Lauren is at up at Tulik Field Station wearing lots of fleece and cold weather clothes. It's because she's part of the Polar Trek program. So the Polar Trek program is a program that's funded by the National Science Foundation, and we've had a number of years of funding from them, and it's an opportunity for K through 12 teachers and a few community college teachers to work with scientists in the Arctic and the Antarctic regions and get hands-on science experience and bring that back to their teaching world. And we've been doing this for quite a while. Now we've placed over 160 teachers with scientists around the polar regions. And Lauren is part of a cohort of about, I think, 15 this year. And we're really excited to have her up at Tulik Field Station. It's a great place in Alaska. And lots of exciting and cutting-edge research goes on at Tulik Field Station in Alaska. Just a little idea of how to do questions during the presentation. It's a small group, so you can raise your hand if you want to, or you can type it in the chat box, and we'll interrupt Lauren and the team and have them address it as we go along. And at the end, you can also do the same thing. We'll have time for questions. Just press the hand button, and we'll call on you. Click on the mic to open up. Click on the talk button to open up the mic. Ask your question, and when you're done, hit the talk button again to close the mic, and then we can all hear the response. So I think that's it, and at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Lauren and the research team. So welcome.
Hi, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us. So we're Team Microbe, and as you heard, we're currently up in the Arctic at Tulik Field Station, and we're in Alaska, so it's still the U.S., and we are examining microbial changes in Arctic freshwater. That's Tulik Field Station in the picture there. So we want to introduce ourselves. As you heard, I'm Lauren Wattel, and I'm the Polar Trek teacher for the project. I teach at St. Mary's Academy.
Hey, guys.
And that's in Inglewood, Colorado. And I teach high school biology and AP Environmental Science. And I've been at Tulik for just about 2 weeks.
And I'm Byron Crump. I'm an associate professor at Oregon State University. And I've been doing research up here in Alaska for about 14 years. And I'm the PI, or principal investigator, on this research project.
And I'm Sarah Nelvin. I just started as a graduate student working for Byron. This is my first time up at Tulik, but I'll be here for the entire summer collecting samples and analyzing them a little bit in the lab.
All right, so to orient you a little bit and give you an idea of where we are, that big blue arrow is showing Tulik Field Station in Alaska. So we are above the Arctic Circle, which is at 66 degrees, 33 minutes latitude, and we're at 68 degrees, 38 minutes north. We're north of the Brooks Range, which is sort of the last major mountain range before you reach the Arctic Ocean. So we're way up there. It's about a 10-hour drive from Fairbanks. So we flew in an airplane to Fairbanks, and then we got in a truck, and we drove all the way up the Dalton Highway for about 10 hours, which is a long drive. And that highway is there following the Alaskan pipeline, and it was built for oil extraction in the 70s. So to give you an idea a little bit about what life at Tulik is like here, if you start looking at the pictures in the upper left-hand corner, those are the weatherport tents where a lot of us sleep. And each of those tents has 3 to 6 beds inside it. Okay. And they get pretty dark. We have blackout screens, and so we can make it like it's nighttime, because as you'll hear, we don't really have a true nighttime. And they have beds, they have dressers, they have electricity and power, a little space heater, and we even have Wi-Fi in them. So it's pretty luxurious. As you move to the right, you'll see the towers. That's where we go to the bathroom, and they're elevated because of the permafrost. You can't bury anything in the ground up here. The ground is frozen, so you can't dig into it very well. So we go up there, and that's where we do our business. And the waste is really a big deal because they have to truck it out. So the waste, they have to pay about $1 a gallon. So we try to minimize waste, and we don't throw any toilet paper or anything into the toilet, just to give you an idea of what it's like. So as you move to the right again, that's our lab. That's the dry lab up here at Tulik, and the outside of it is shown in the green picture. And that's where we spend all our time prepping for the field and where we do all the sample processing and analysis that you'll hear about. So then as you move around clockwise, the next picture that looks like there's a fire, that is a bonfire, that's our party to celebrate the summer solstice, or the first day of summer. So we had a costume party and a bonfire, and that picture was taken at about 10 p.m., so it's still really light out. And then the picture above that shows the dining hall where we eat all our meals. There's really good food prepared here, plenty of drinks and snacks. You can't go hungry. An unlimited supply of candy and ice cream, which is not always a good thing, but it works. So up here in the tundra, as I said, we don't have a true nighttime. So that picture showing the sun is the lowest the sun really gets. that picture was taken at 3 a.m., and that's still really light out. So it never even gets dusky. The sun doesn't go below the horizon at all. And that kind of tricks your body a little bit. Then we also have some really nice weather, beautiful days, as you can see in the upper right-hand corner. There I am out at a lake. Nice breeze. It's warm. But then we also have days that are kind of like today, shown in the bottom left, where that's an Arctic ground squirrel hanging out in the fog. Cold, rainy, foggy. It goes lots of different conditions. And then you can see Sarah in her bug shirt. There are lots of mosquitoes out that we have to try to avoid. And then the bottom right shows the tussocks, which are some of the plant life on the tundra. It's not all covered in ice and snow. In fact, there's actually hardly any ice and snow left anywhere in this area. So those are the tussocks, and they're kind of tricky mounds of grass to walk on.
Yeah, they're big, big lumps on the tundra. The tussocks are really hard to walk over. And if you're not careful, you can turn your ankle on them. Some people say that walking on tundra is like walking on a thick, soggy sponge laid over a whole lot of bowling balls. And those tussocks, those are the bowling balls.
Let's give you a little bit of an idea about our project.
All right. So the research project we're working on is funded by the National Science Foundation. And it's all about this question: what controls long-term changes in freshwater microbial community composition? Okay, which is another way of asking, what decides the types of microbes that grow in freshwater? So this is kind of like asking, what causes certain types of fish to grow in a lake, or what causes certain types of weeds to grow in your garden? It's a project about the biodiversity of microbes. And the reason we're interested in microbes is that they grow very quickly, and they're very sensitive to changes in their environment. Okay, so when something important happens in an environment, like the temperature changes or the kind of food changes, then the microbes change. Right? So you can think of these microbial communities as the first responders to environmental change. And the way that they respond is by changing the species that make up those communities. So here in the Arctic, the climate is changing pretty quickly, more quickly than it is farther south. And at some point, the plant communities that you can see on the tundra there and the animal communities, those are going to change. But that's going to take a little bit of time. The microbial communities, they're going to change first. And they'll give us a signal of the biologically important effects of climate change, the changes that matter to the biology. And that's what we're interested in. So microbes are tiny organisms. They're usually only one cell big, and they can only be seen with a microscope, microbe microscope. So microbes are things like bacteria and protozoa and single-celled algae. Some people even think viruses are microbes. But don't be fooled. You know, microbes may be small, but there are a lot of them. A teaspoon of water, of lake water here from the lake, contains 4 million bacterial cells. Right. So, and the other thing is about microbes is that they grow really fast. So they're really important in ecosystems. Particularly ecosystems, aquatic ecosystems like lakes and rivers and the ocean. So way back in the 1990s, right, when scientists got really good at sequencing DNA, some scientists went out into oceans and lakes and started sequencing genes from the microbes that were out there. And they found just a huge number of microbial species. And the thing was that most of those species were organisms that we didn't know anything about. They were completely unknown. We didn't know they existed. So part of what we're doing up here is discovering brand new species of microbes. And doing that's particularly challenging because there's a lot to deal with, a lot of different species to deal with. So imagine if you were trying to count up all the different bird species in the United States. Right, get out your bird book, start counting through them. There might be hundreds, right? Maybe over 1,000 species, something like that, across the whole country. Right here in Tulik Lake alone, we have at least 10,000 species of bacteria, right? Just in this lake. So the number of species to deal with is remarkably big.
Are microbes really those colors?
Microbes are not really those colors. That's just for your benefit. Although some of them are green, that's true, and some of them are pink. So those two are right. I think the bacteria can be purple. The bacteria can be purple. So I guess it's not far off, you know. Yeah.
Probably not quite that vibrant.
There's also a question about what process to use for the DNA sequencing.
So we'll answer that in just a couple of slides. So hold on.
Do I get to that? I think I did.
Yeah. Anyway. I see.
So what do these bacteria, what do these microbes do in ecosystems? The microbes that I'm most interested in are the bacteria, right? And I like to think of them as the back end of the food web, right? So this on here is the classic food web that you find in lakes and the ocean. And the way it works is that nutrition like phosphorus and nitrogen is used by these microscopic plants that we call phytoplankton. And these are also microbes. They're a little bit bigger than bacteria. But they take those nutrients and they make new biomass. Then the little zooplankton, they eat the phytoplankton, and the fish eat the zooplankton. Classic food chain, right? But what happens when the ecosystem starts running out of nitrogen and phosphorus? This whole chain just shuts down, right? This is where the bacteria come in. The bacteria take the dead leftovers of the phytoplankton and the zooplankton and even the dead fish, and they use it as food. And when they do that, they release the nitrogen and the phosphorus in that dead material and send it back around for the phytoplankton to use again. It's kind of like recycling. Now, the other thing that the bacteria do is when they use all that dead material as food, they turn it back into carbon dioxide. They kind of clean things up, right? So if the bacteria weren't doing this job, we'd have stuff piling up. We'd have dead fish piling up all around us. And the bacteria are what clean that up. All right, so how big are the bacteria? Kind of hard to picture, I know. Even when you look in the microscope, you can see them, but you're like, well, how big is that really? So if you say you had one big, beefy bacteria that was about 1 micron long, right, that's a big one. And that's a micron is about 1,000 times smaller than a millimeter. Okay, and you blew that up 400 trillion times. How big do you think that would be? Does anybody have a guess for me?
You can type it in the chat box.
Yeah, you don't have to say it. Give me something like a
grain of rice. We have a
grain guess. Of rice. Close, but bigger. that's a different question.
Grain of rice is what they're saying.
Grain of rice, that's what they got. Okay, well, like, try to say it.
Yeah.
It's actually the size of
jelly bean. Dime.
Jelly bean is pretty getting closer. Dime.
Cheerios.
Mm-hmm. They do look a little bit like Cheerios. They get to be the size of a baseball, right? So you blow up this little bacteria 420 times, it gets to be the size of a baseball. And if you take that teaspoon of water that I was talking about before that had 400 million bacteria in it and blow that up 400 trillion times, it's the size of a baseball stadium. So that's the sizing that we're thinking about. This here on the right here, we have pictures of colorized bacteria. I think the artist took some effort to make them pink for you. And that's sitting around a hair follicle. Bacteria are everywhere, right? And almost all of them are friendly and good for us, right? And they're good for the environment. They're an important part of our world. So I had a question here. Do all lake bacteria produce carbon dioxide, or do some produce methane or other gases? The bacteria, well, this is an interesting question. Most of the bacteria in the lake produce carbon dioxide. The organisms that produce methane live in special environments where there's no oxygen, right? So you have to go down into the sediments where there's no oxygen around. And then it's this relative of bacteria called archaea that produce methane. So methane does get produced up here, but there's a lot more carbon dioxide get produced.
All right. So I want to talk a little bit about what we do in the field. So Sarah just got back from being out in the lake collecting some samples. And what she was doing out there and what we've done on other days is you go out and you gather some sample water from sites that they've pre-selected and sample year after year after year. And you gather that water. And to get to those places, I should have said this, but to get to those places, we either hike, or we might drive a little bit and then walk, or we take a helicopter, which is a pretty cool mode of transportation to get around in the tundra. It's pretty awesome. And once we get that sample water, we take it and we force it through these little filters, which, let me try to get a pointer. You can see, maybe, you see this? You can see this point, this, I guess I'm pointing with the sun. But in the left-hand picture, we force the water through a syringe and into a filter. That filter is going to have small enough holes that the bacteria can't fit through it. And it's going to capture the bacteria and leave them in that filter, and all the water is going to pass through. And then we bring those filters back to the lab, and we've killed the bacteria so that they don't keep growing and changing on us. But we want to see which bacteria were there when we remove them from the water. So we bring that back to the lab, and I'll talk about what we do there. But we do a lot of careful sample collection and analysis and data recording to keep track of everything. And sometimes we have to remove water from the stream. This is actually removing water from the stream that is below the sediment and the rocks in the stream. So we use this little sort of tube that is hammered down into the sediments to get it. So lots and lots of different techniques to get the bacteria out of the water. And we filter about 1 liter of water, one Nalgene bottle, for each of those filters, each of those sites. And here's a close-up of the filters. So we bring those back to the lab, and you can see the different colors. Those are from two different locations, and even the colors can tell us that there's something different going on in each of those spots. So we bring those back, and we literally crack them open so that we can start the process and remove that filter paper. So what we're trying to do through this lab analysis process is here we have our little bacteria hanging out in our sample, and we're going to try to break open their cells so that we can start to remove the DNA that is contained inside of them, or their genetic code that is in each and every single one of their cells, and or of the cells that are present. It's the same DNA, or very similar DNA, as to what's in your cells. Same genetic letters and makeup is what's there. So our goal is to get this DNA separated from their cells. So to do that, there's a lot of different processes of adding some different chemicals and enzymes to them to start breaking things open. We freeze and thaw them to disrupt things and kind of startle them to, you know, pull things apart. And then there's a lot of careful pipetting or removing of the parts that we don't want and saving the parts that we do want so that we finally end up with a little tiny clump of DNA, which you can't really see in this picture because we can barely see it, but it kind of looks like a little bit of a booger in the bottom of the tube, which is what we are excited to find. And once they've gotten that little sample of DNA, they send it back to Oregon State for analysis. And they essentially use PCR, or polymerase chain reaction, to make a bunch of copies of the DNA, because we need lots and lots of copies in order to be able to see it. And then they use some gel electrophoresis to check if it's present and if they've actually got DNA that they wanted. And then they use sequencing to figure out the actual spelling or the letter order of that DNA to figure out who is there. It's like a barcode trying to see okay, which item is this, which bacteria is that, so that they can figure out who's actually present. So did you want to say
that's what right.
sequencing for that question?
Yeah, we use, so once we make those pieces of DNA to sequence with polymerase chain reaction, we send them to the DNA sequencing experts at our genome sequencing center at Oregon State University. And they do the sequencing on an Illumina MiSeq sequencer, if you know what that is. It's the latest and greatest DNA sequencer. And then they email us the data. And that's when the fun really starts. We get to look at, to see what types of bacteria we have.
So to answer Cyan's question of how long does it take for sequencing and to get the data back, how long?
If we're first in line, when we hand them the DNA, they can send us the data back 2 days later. So it's very fast. You know, although it takes us days and weeks to do all the DNA extractions and all the polymerase chain reactions and running these gels, it takes a long time to get up to that little tube that we give to the DNA sequencing, and then we get all this data.
And then our other question, can you use this DNA to trace the origin of the bacteria similar to a family tree?
It's exactly what we do. You know, the piece of DNA, the gene, right, that we sequence is kind of like a fingerprint gene for bacteria. And you can compare the DNA sequence of that gene to a whole database of gene sequences and see which one it matches up with best. And the one that it matches up with best, it has a little name there and tells you what it is.
Okay, hold on. Illumina sequencing.
Right, Illumina sequencing.
So can you get back information about the whole community of microbes at once?
That's what we do. So when we make copies of that gene that we're interested in, we make copies of that gene from all of the bacteria in the sample. And then we send it to the sequencing center, and they send back all these sequences. Well, how many do we get in a run? I think it's like 5 million. No, that was 2 years ago. It's 30 million DNA sequences that we get back. And you can sort through them and identify all the little bacteria. So that's how I got that number 10,000 species in one sample from the lake. There were a lot of sequences, but they all kind of grouped up into little groups, and there were 10,000.
And then have you found any new species that you've gotten to name?
No, that would be cool. No, you know, they don't, the rules of the game are in order to name a bacteria, you have to grow it in the laboratory first. In pure culture on petri plates or something, and learn more about what it's physically able to do. All we get to find out is its name, you know, and or who it's related to.
So yes, we've found plenty of new bacteria, but we haven't done enough work to get to name them.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay, so. So we've been sampling, I've been sampling Tulik Lake since the year 2000, right? My first trip up here was in 2000, to see how the bacterial, time's up, just a second.
Lights went out.
All right, we go. The lights are on a timer to save energy because energy costs a lot up here. Anyway, so, and we wanted to do that to look at how the bacterial communities change over time. So back in 2000, we found that the bacteria in Tulik Lake changed with the seasons. We had a winter community that we sampled by drilling through the ice. And then we had a spring community after things started to thaw. And then we had a summer community. So after that first year, I was like, well, let's go see if it happens again. So we continued to sample the next year. In the next year, to see if the same species came back. Okay, so I can switch it. So this lake is frozen over from October until May. Right? It's a pretty long time. And during that time, there's this winter bacterial community that lives under the ice, in the dark, under the ice, which is under the snow, just kind of toughing it out over the winter for many months. in some very cold water. And then the spring starts, and the snow starts to melt, and all that water spills off of the tundra down under the ice into the lake, and it brings with it a lot of new food, because that snow has been sitting on old leaves and some soil and other things, kind of extracting material from it. And it spills into the lake, and the bacteria have a field day. They go crazy because it's all this new food, right? And when that happens, there are certain types of bacteria that do really well with that new food, and it makes the community change. So that winter community starts to kind of go into the background, and this new community, the spring community, develops, right? And that's and on this figure, these circles represent different groups of bacteria, groups of species, right? So you have a change from a winter community to the spring community. Then the ice melts, and the lake opens up, and that spring community starts to change, and it transitions through a couple different groups, and then after about a month and a half, a summer community forms, and that summer community stays there until the ice forms again in the spring. And the amazing thing is that this cycle has happened for the last, I think I have data for 11 years, right? 11 years the communities keep coming back and keep coming back. Just like old friends, I guess. Lake bacteria are great, but there's lots of other environments that bacteria live in on the tundra. And in fact, all the different environments on the tundra, they each have their own special groups of bacteria. Right? So we're very interested in how all these different groups of bacteria move around.
We lost you guys there for a little bit, Byron. I can't hear you. We can't hear you. Let me turn off their video.
Going down the landscape. So we're studying the diverse, and one way to do that is to study the diversity of bacteria in streams like this one here. This is about 2 kilometers.
Lauren, I don't know if you guys can hear us.
Mile and a half long stream that comes out of this little lake up high.
Why don't you, if you can hear me, Lauren?
All right, should I start on stream?
Are we back? Can you hear us?
You are now.
Okay.
Yes, Lauren, go ahead. You guys can try doing the video again, and we'll see. There.
Got it.
Yep, I see your video.
So now we are back.
Yeah.
All right.
It might have been causing a little bit of bandwidth issues there.
Okay.
All right. Anyway, so I was talking about this stream that we like. It comes out of a lake, moves across the tundra, goes into the next lake. And streams are very complicated environments, right? Because there's so many different little environments involved, right, for the bacteria. So there's bacteria growing, like, in the water, of course. But there's bacteria growing on the rocks at the bottom of the stream and in the sediments at the bottom of the stream and growing on plants that might be growing in the stream. Then there's bacteria in the soils that are form the banks of the stream. And I guess in the under the stream too. Anyway, there's lots of different environments, and it turns out, go ahead and switch it, that each of these environments has their own special group of bacteria, right? And in our study, we've learned that all of those different, the bacteria in all those different environments contribute organisms to the stream. So the stream water has the most different types of bacteria because it gets bacteria that jump on board from the soils and the soil waters. They get rinsed, they get washed off the rocks, and create this very diverse group of organisms in the stream. And it carries them downstream where they can find new rocks and new soils and new sediments to live in. Okay? So can anybody think of some other special stream environments that might have their own groups of bacteria that maybe we didn't sample? You all have been in streams before. You can just type it in.
So should we list the ones we sampled again?
Yeah, we sampled the rocks, the sediments, the plants. Living on fish, very good. We couldn't catch any fish. We thought about that. Yeah, I think living on the plants was definitely, we did that one. We were thinking about the insects that live in the water. Those are good ones. What else? You got one?
Dead leaves was another one.
Dead leaves, yeah.
Rain coming in.
Oh, and the rain, man. Rain is very, it just makes things complicated. Anyway, so.
You ready for the next one?
Yeah. So how does this all fit into the big picture? You've probably heard about climate change, right? Climate change has been going on. Well, it turns out that those climate changes are happening first and most quickly in the Arctic. Picture in the Arctic and in the Antarctic, right? The poles are experiencing climate change more rapidly. So annual air temperature in the Arctic is increased by as much as 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit over the last 50 years. Oh yeah, I like that one. Animals drink from the streams. They probably do other things in the streams as well. Yes. Anyway, so the temperature up here over the last 50 years has increased on average by as much as 7 degrees Fahrenheit. And the forecast is that it's going to continue to rise. And with that increase in temperature, there's going to be more precipitation, and scientists think that it'll take the form of snow in the winter. There'll be more snow in the winter. And that the summers are going to get longer. A longer growing season for the plants. So these are the kind of changes that, have you noticed the temperature change over the 14 years you've been there? 7 degrees is a lot. But you can see on the map where that's happened, the 7 degree changes.
The dark red.
The dark red. Those right here at Tulip Lake, we have not seen that temperature change yet. If you go closer to the coast, to the north, it definitely happened. We have a very good record there. And here, it's lagging here up against the mountains. We think we might be in a little microclimate or something. But it's kind of interesting, considering that I have this 10-year project, I was expecting something to happen. I have a great background set of data now, 10 years. Anyway, so these are the kind of seasonal changes that might drive our bacterial communities to change, right? And get thrown off that seasonal cycle. So our old friends, they could disappear and get replaced with a whole new group of bacteria in the summer if the temperature changes. I know, Tulip doesn't look like it's that far from the coast, but it's about a 3.5-hour drive to the coast from here.
We're driving there tomorrow.
In fact, we're driving there tomorrow.
All right. Okay. Do you want to talk about some of the changes you have seen?
All right. Let me tell you about some of the changes we have seen. So we expected there to be temperature change, but instead there's these other things that are happening. And one of them is called thermokarst, right, which sounds very dramatic. And when you're there, when you see one, it actually is pretty dramatic. The Arctic is a special place because it's covered with a thick layer of frozen soil. Right, that we call permafrost. In fact, half of the soil on the planet is in the Arctic, frozen in this permafrost. It's a very thick layer. And some areas around Tulik, when the permafrost thaws, it can cause landslides, like the one in this picture. So this is a kind of thermokarst. And this happened on the edge of the lake.
Shoot. Okay, are we... You say we're back.
Somebody asked if I've seen the lake ice melting earlier and freezing later. You know, what's happening is it's not statistically melting earlier, but the thaw date is becoming more variable, right? Sometimes it's later than it's been before, sometimes earlier than it's been before. So things are getting a little crazy, which is kind of what's happening.
The last ice left the lake on Friday, so a week, just over a week ago.
Right.
Just over a week ago, it finally got rid of its ice.
And that's about the middle of time period. Sometimes it happens a little later, but we've been getting these earlier thaws every once in a while too. Trying to interpret that. But the things we definitely know are happening are these thermokarsts, and they seem to be happening more and more. So this thermokarst here happened on the edge of a lake that we've been sampling for the last 8 years, right? And this is a lake that we call lake number 345, right? We sample about 50 different lakes a year, and they all have numbers, right? Some of them have names like Tulip, but most of them do not. Well, a couple years ago, on this lake, some students were walking around and they noticed this landslide starting, this thermokarst. And when they saw that, they also saw around the side of the lake a wolverine, which is this guy here, chasing a caribou, right, which is this giant deer-like.
Like a reindeer.
Yeah, it's a reindeer. And, the caribou kind of fought him off, but the students were so impressed with the wolverine that they named the lake after him. So this thermokarst is on Wolverine Lake. And so we've been watching this thermokarst on Wolverine Lake for a couple years now, and it's slowly getting bigger and bigger, dumping more and more of this ancient soil into the lake from the permafrost, right? And this winter, we're going to be analyzing our DNA samples to see if that new soil, all that new stuff, is throwing the bacteria off of their annual cycle if we have new organisms growing. Yes, it's a very slow, it's a pretty slow slide. Things just sort of lop off. We're setting up a stop-motion camera to try to get it, to capture it, and maybe make it a little bit more dynamic right now. But you can find some stop-motion movies on YouTube of different thermokarsts if you look for them.
So the permafrost cycle, how big is a wolverine? Looks like a bear. They're a lot smaller.
How big is a wolverine? It's the size of a dog, I'd say.
Small dog.
Yeah.
Small dog.
Big raccoon.
Not like your little chihuahuas. All right, so with permafrost, you know the saying, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas? Well, that's not the case with the Arctic. What happens in the Arctic does not stay in the Arctic. So as that permafrost melts, that permafrost is only in the Arctic, but it's full of that dead material that we talked about. So plants and things that have died and have been there for thousands of years, or hundreds of years, depending on what part of the permafrost you're in. And it's going to start to thaw. So the permafrost is like your freezer. The food that's in your freezer is preserved. Once it starts to thaw, it can start to go bad and get moldy. That's what's going to happen to that dead material as the permafrost melts. So as it starts to get moldy, that's decomposition that's happening. It's being broken down. And one of the main things that helps break it down are bacteria. And that bacteria, when it's chowing down on this new food, it's going to be releasing carbon dioxide. Just like when you breathe out carbon dioxide. So that carbon dioxide, they're going to release it into the atmosphere, and it's going up into the air, and that carbon dioxide has been shown to correlate and match up with increases in temperature. So the more CO2 in the air, the higher the temperature. And that air, it moves around. And the air that's in the Arctic circulates, and it moves down into other parts of the world and can circulate down into the northern hemisphere where the U.S., the continent, like where you guys are, within about a year. And it can cover and get into the rest of the whole world in about 4 years. So it's really not staying put. We're releasing a bunch of carbon up here, and it's going to impact everybody in the entire world. In not very long. So that's why we care about what's happening in the Arctic with these permafrosts and things that are so far away from you guys, but they're going to impact each of us. It might even cause it to where Denver warms up enough and it might not snow as much or snow at all anymore. And that would be crazy for us to think about. No more snow days. I want snow days.
So sad.
All right. So that's kind of giving you an idea of how our project has been working and why we're doing this project and what we're learning. So now's a great time. If you guys have any questions, that you can type them in, or I'll turn off my mic and you can ask. Oh, there's one right now. Do you have to worry about bears?
The answer is yes.
So not polar bears. Polar bears don't come this far south in the Arctic. But grizzly bears are around, and we do have to bring bear spray with us in case they're nearby. But I haven't seen any, and Byron hasn't seen any.
I've only seen them from the helicopter. But we still carry the bear spray, which is kind of like pepper spray, but it's a big pepper spray.
Yeah, powerful. We did see a wolf from the helicopter a couple days ago. But besides birds and that one wolf and a moose on the drive up, and some doll sheep, which are like our mountain goats. We haven't really seen too much wildlife.
Yeah, this is Janet. So if you guys have questions that you want to ask, just click on the little hand icon, especially if you're from Lawrence School, if you guys want to ask them live. We got St. Mary's Academy. Lauren, can you guys click on your talk button and close your mic?
Wow.
Okay. And we'll go to St. Mary's.
What do you guys see up there?
That was hard to hear. Can you repeat the question or somebody closer to the mic?
What do you guys see up there?
Is the question, what do you eat up there?
Yep, it is. I got it. So we eat a lot of really good food. We had a seafood pasta dish last night. We've had prime rib. We have hot dogs with all the different toppings. We had ahi tuna steaks. What else did we have? We had Reuben sandwiches.
Reuben.
And waffles. And
fresh salad bar.
A lot of salads. Fruit.
And every breakfast they have lots of bacon.
Oh, yeah. A lot of bacon. And there's a baker that makes fresh bread almost every day, which is amazing. And really good desserts.
The food gets trucked in twice a week. And, you know, the funny thing is it costs so much to get the food up here that it kind of doesn't matter what they buy. You know, so they tend to buy slightly more expensive food. But most of the cost is really in the transportation, getting it onto the North Slope of Alaska. We benefit from that. So they just buy it. They buy nice food.
They do accommodate vegans and vegetarians. Yeah. We just don't happen to be those things.
Well, actually, that's not true. So I'm a vegetarian for the summer, even though normally I'm not, because they have to know how much meat, how many meat dishes to cook and how many vegetarian dishes to cook. So you have to decide what you are for the entire summer, and you're not allowed to be a flexitarian. So yesterday, when they made Reubens, I was really, really, really sad that I had chosen the vegetarian option.
The temperature range day and night this time of year. So between daytime and nighttime, it's really not that dramatic of a difference. Maybe 10 degrees Fahrenheit throughout the day, sometimes a little bit more if they've had a storm come through and it cooled it off or, you know, really got sunny for a while. I think it was in the low 70s the first day when we arrived, but currently it's in the low 30s. So we've experienced some big temperature fluctuations due to the weather, and it's been kind of raining cold, which also answers, have the mosquitoes been bad? No, not really, which is awesome. We have worn our bug shirts, and we have all gotten mosquito bites, but they're nothing like they could be, and how Tulik is legendary in a way for their mosquitoes. So it's been cold. They haven't really gotten too, you know, crazy swarmish yet, and that will change.
That's coming in July. sometimes they have contests about how many mosquitoes you can kill with one hand slap. And I think the record is a little over 200.
Okay, what is the coolest thing you have learned? Go ahead. Live question? Okay.
Well, I just wanted to see if Eric wanted to ask that question live. So, Eric, if you want to turn on your mic, go ahead, because it worked earlier.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, and each of you can answer this, but what's the coolest thing you've learned during your time up there?
Oh. Great question. Go ahead, Laura.
I can think of two different things right away to say. Are we on?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So one has to do with the bacteria. So out in the oceans, one of the first new bacteria that was discovered was this bacteria that they named Pelagibacter, right? And it is the most abundant bacteria on the planet. It's very abundant in the oceans, and it's everywhere, right? And it's a good bacteria. It's pretty cool. They're really small. In Two Lake Lake, we discovered the freshwater relative of that ocean bacteria, and it's very abundant in our lake. So even though we're in freshwater, not ocean water, there's a relative here, and that was discovered here. Now, that was one of the cool things. Mm-hmm. Another cool thing. Oh, do you have a cool thing?
You go first. I can't.
Well, the other cool thing doesn't have to do with bacteria. But when I first came up here, there was never any thunderstorms. And the old-timers, you know, I'm not quite an old-timer yet. I'm almost an old-timer. But the old-timers, they say they never saw thunder, no lightning. Now it happens all the time, you know. And that lightning is starting to cause fires. It's lighting the tundra on fire. And a few years ago, there was a fire about an hour helicopter flight from here that burned between these two rivers, and it burned a patch of the tundra that was the size of Cape Cod. It was a very big area, just burned, right? And that's starting to happen more and more up here. So things have changed quite a bit.
I think the coolest thing that I've learned while I was up here is how much research is actually taking place. And even though we're really far away from any city, how much that does not hinder or make it harder to do really cool research. So the researchers really collaborate and talk to each other and talk about their projects. Someone said it's kind of like science or summer camp for science nerds. So our mealtime conversations are pretty nerdy, but really interesting. You learn a lot of really cool stuff along the way. And so how many people total are at the camp doing research right now?
The camp gets to be as much as about 100 people in July. And it's more like 50 to 75 people earlier and later in August. So that's the numbers. How many months out of the year do you say? Our project, we sample for 3 months. But we have some people who come up earlier to drill through the ice to sample. And now we have a group that's staying later all the way until October to collect samples. So we're starting to stretch our season.
I'll turn off my mic if somebody else comes back.
Yeah, this is a great great question from Eric and also from St. Mary's. Is there anybody else that has questions that they want to ask live? We got one hand up at St. Mary's Academy. So go ahead, guys.
What do you think of fun?
Okay, I didn't catch that one. Go ahead. Repeat it one more time and slower and louder. Oh, what do you do for fun? All right, go ahead, Laura.
All right, so fun. Well, we work quite a bit. We generally don't leave the lab until 9 o'clock or later at night. But after that, we might go down to the sauna, which is by the lake, and we can get nice and toasty and then jump in the lake for a nice, cool, refreshing, almost like a shower, because we can only take 2 showers a week for 2 minutes apiece. Using the sauna to bathe is helpful, so we do that. Or we have a like trivia night coming up on Saturday, and what else? People can go hiking and bike riding around a little bit. It's The weather's nice.
Yeah, we're very close to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and we're close to the gates of the Arctic National Park, and there's lots of good hiking there.
And we there's also lots of, like, board games. There was a World Cup, Tulik Cup soccer match last night. So there's lots of things going on if you happen to be able to get away from your work.
Hold on.
We'll let the next live question come, then I'll come back.
Okay, yeah, so Bill has a question. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, it sounds like there's lots of other research projects going on. Can you describe anything about those? Has there been any one of them that sounded really interesting or anything like that?
There's so many to talk about. There's people studying everything from, you know, the weather and the atmosphere to the ground squirrels that are running around camp. I guess one of the big ones is the ground squirrels have a special way of surviving the winter. They let their bodies get extremely cold, but they've got special enzymes that keep their bodies from freezing for 9 months of the year during when it's frozen. And so people are studying those enzymes and how they manage to do that. That's one really cool project.
Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of collaboration. I think that's what's really cool. So there's lakes teams, there's plant teams, there's atmosphere teams, lots and lots of different things. So Diane asked, what are you going up the coast for?
There's all these, you know, we're up here by the mountains and the lakes are a certain way. But if you go down to the coast, there's more lakes and they're shallower. They're really like a few feet deep, but there's tons of them. So we want to sample some of the different kinds of lakes.
Okay, St. Mary's asked, is there any risk of disturbing the natural bacteria populations by you guys getting in the lake?
No, I don't think so. There's too much dilution. Plus, the sauna is positioned in a place where the lake water moves by and goes to the outlet. So where we do our sampling is way across the lake, away from the sauna, to make sure that we don't get that signal, the people signal.
And the lake is fun. There's also a slide that goes into it. If you happen to be daring enough to take the little water slide plunge, if you can manage to stay out in the cold that long, it could be fun.
It's cold.
Are there fish in the lake?
Yes, there are grayling and Arctic char, and I think there might be some trout also.
And there's projects going on to study those. They go out and they catch the fish to see how the fish populations are doing and see how they're, like, what they're eating and see how their populations are changing as well.
Okay. We have time for a few more questions if anybody wants to ask one live. Tori sounds out. Sounds like you're having a great time. Anybody else? Okay, St. Mary's, go ahead.
Nice and slow. Is there fall?
I didn't get that one. Is there fall there? You mean like fall to season?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, Lauren.
Thank you, Danielle. Oh, sorry there.
All right, we're back. Go ahead.
Okay, yes, there is a fall. Just when things are starting, the lakes are starting to freeze up, the deciduous plants, the trees that drop their leaves, there aren't really trees, and you can see in the picture here, there's no trees up here, and that's because of the permafrost. The soil that is not frozen is only about this deep, you know, maybe at a foot at the most. So there's no room for the trees to get very big. But so the trees are all really tiny. They have birch trees. We have willow trees. But they're really small. But it's fall anyway. They drop the leaves just like the trees down by where you live.
And they turn red.
Yeah, they change colors.
Change colors.
So what does the beachfront look like? Well, there's not really a sandy beach. There's a little bit of a rocky areas along the lake, but there are docks that they put into the water so that you don't have to walk on the rocks to get into the water, so that you can get in and out really fast, because pretty much the second you're in, you want out. It's really, really cold water. Like I said, the ice just left last week. Does the tundra change colors?
Yeah, Janet's right. It does change colors.
Okay. Yes, the tundra does. Red, golden, brown. So as the tundra melts, would you expect the small trees to start to grow bigger and become bigger?
Yes, that's one of the big hypotheses, and they're starting to see evidence of that farther north, up by Barrow, Alaska, which is the farthest north place.
Which is where Cyan is going on her expedition.
That's right. So they're calling it shrubification, because the shrubs are getting bigger, and eventually they might be trees.
Okay, anybody else that wants to ask live questions? Let's see. Okay, yeah, one from St. Mary's. I'll let you guys respond.
All right, would tree growth in the Arctic have a significant effect on climate change?
Maybe.
We don't know.
Yeah, trees are really good at pulling carbon dioxide out of the air and storing it as wood. And we don't have that happening up here in the North Slope because there isn't that much wood, right? So maybe it would have an effect.
Mm-hmm. Who knows? Maybe you should research that.
Yeah, this is Janet. We had a research team. I was trying to find it that was looking at tree growth and the migration of trees and vegetation moving northward a few years ago. The teacher's name was Susie Ellison, and the researchers came from back east. Anyway, I'll try to find the link and post it here in the meantime. Is there anybody else that has questions for the team? Otherwise, we'll start to sign off. Oh, St. Mary's, go ahead. It looks like you have another one.
Is microbes roaming in Alaska? Are there
microbes roaming in Alaska? I didn't quite catch that either. Can somebody repeat that? They're writing it down, it looks like, for us.
So we think, yeah, we got it.
I think we got it. No, wow. There are microbes everywhere on the planet.
Including on you and in you.
Yeah, they grow in your gut. They help you digest your food.
So they're pretty much on every surface you can think of. And most of them are not bad for you. The majority are not harmful or actually help you.
Yeah, they're very good.
We can survive without them.
How do the numbers? Good question. There's actually about 10 times more microbial cells in your body than there are human cells. And that's because they're really small.
Okay. Anything else from St. Mary's or anybody else?
How many more microbes? About 10 times more microbial cells than human cells.
So I guess as a philosophical question, you can go ponder that. Are you more microbe than human? It's a good one.
Who's the host and who is the symbiont?
That is a complex question. All right. Okay, well, we've gone for about an hour here. So, St. Mary's, do you have any more questions? They're chatting. Anybody else? Okay. I wanted to thank the research team and Lauren for pulling this all together and for all of you joining us. There is another Polar Trek, Polar Connect event coming up in July 8th, also from Actually, the teacher won't be at Tulip Field Station, but with another team at Tulip Field Station, and the teacher will be back home, but it's with Regina, and about her work that she's been doing up there and about the carbon cycle, so that should be pretty interesting. And like always, I just wanted to remind you that we'll archive this and we'll post it online, so if you need to share it with somebody or check back and get a refresher about microbes, you're welcome to do so. And thanks again, everybody, for joining. It was really very well done. Thank you. All right. Well, keep up the good work, Lauren and team, and we look forward to following you the rest of your time there.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Thanks.